Hello, and welcome to Spectology, the science fiction book club podcast. I'm your host, Adrian.
And I'm Matt.
Welcome, Matt.
Welcome, buddy.
Hey. So Spectology is a book club podcast where every month we pick a book, read it, and talk about it over the course of two episodes. We also do bonus episodes, like this one right here.
Bonus-ode.
Where we bonus-ode. Wow.
It's such a gross word.
Uh-oh. I've never heard a thought of that word before, and I just had to stop a little. We do bonus-odes, I suppose. Where
No, don't say it more. What have I done?
We do bonus episodes where we talk about other science fiction-related stuff. This week, we're actually going to do a topic, what we call like our in-conversation series, where we just pick a topic in sci-fi and like, you know, kind of noodle on it for 20 minutes or so. We're going to do one that we've thought about since the very beginning of the podcast. This is like written down in some of the first notes we ever did, which is talking about truly alien aliens and how that kind of presents itself in various science fiction books, media, etc. Probably we'll focus on books because that's what we like here. And we also like movies. I don't know. I'm going to stop talking. Matt, how are you doing?
doing all right, buddy. You know, strange time to be alive, but great time to talk about science fiction.
Indeed it is.
So aliens is an interesting topic because I think there are... what you just said there was interesting. You said truly alien aliens. And that to me is one of the things that distinguishes a science fictional approach to aliens from other approaches. So in fantasy, there's a very common trope that people often think of as descending from Tolkien, although it has other roots. The trope of depicting non-human species that are human-like in many ways, that speak human languages, that interact with humans, that intermarry, that have a society that, you know, is mingled with human society.
Right.
And these races, you know, are sort of in many ways akin to the way aliens are sometimes dealt with in science fiction. But one thing that science fiction does a lot more typically than other kinds of genres is it tries to depict aliens. It tries to depict intelligence or sentience or some sort of meaningful existence in a form that is really not human, that is truly alien and different. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's interesting to me about this topic is thinking about the difference between different ways of thinking about what it means to be alien.
Right. Like, what does it mean to be a truly alien alien? On what axis is it maybe different from us? And then, I think we talk about this a lot, like science fiction, even when it's about these truly alien aliens, is also like about us. Right. Still, it's still about like our experience. At the end of the day, it comes from our experience. So sort of like, what do these aliens maybe tell us about ourselves and our own fears or our own desires or our own fill in the blank with what have you?
Windows are also mirrors, Adrian.
Yes, sure.
Another aspect of this that is very important, I think, to bring up front is the way that depicting non-humans in fiction so often becomes about race.
Right.
Or about, I mean, race in so many ways is this sort of arbitrary concept that exists in the culture as like an exact analog to a fictional depiction of some non-human species. Like it's a fictional depiction of a non-human species in so many cases, right?
Right.
That's like what sort of race ends up being a lot of the time. And so these things are very closely related, I think. Certainly there are a lot of really good investigations of the racial politics of fantasy races, for example. I mean, anyone who's... This is sort of a little bit more about fantasy, but just for a second, like just because I think it provides good context for the science fiction stuff. Orcs, right? If anybody's ever seen Lord of the Rings or played D&D or... Right.
Or read Lord of the Rings books in particular.
Or read the Lord of the Rings books or engaged in any way with sort of modern high fantasy, you've probably encountered the concept of an orc. What is an orc? Among other things, among other things, it's often seen as a kind of literalization of a very negative view of subaltern ethnic group. And
this is why I called out the Lord of the Rings books in particular, because I feel like the books make it pretty clear that the orcs are sort of these stand-ins for maybe like, you know, Africans or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. I think they're simultaneously, my view personally is that they're simultaneously stand-ins for like a lot of things, and it's not right. exactly clean the way that they map
right.
to negative groups.
But they are still stand-ins for like right. a lot of these right. kind of like ethnic stereotypes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And so I think when we talk about science fiction depictions of aliens, I mean, this is something we have to keep very aware of because...
So I completely agree, but I'm also much more interested in having this conversation about like specifics instead of just like the general theory of all this.
Let's get specific.
So I'm curious, Matt, what are some like one or two of your favorite books that like are favorite in the access of like they have really good aliens?
Oh man, I mean, podcast listeners will know that I very much enjoyed Children of Time, which by Adrian Tchaikovsky, which is a book that we covered in this podcast a few months ago, and
over a year ago at this point.
Oh wow, yeah, wow, you're right.
That was over our eighth book, and we're on 25 now.
That's pretty wild. That is a super fun book about. Human society in the far future and also alien society in the far future. Mm-hmm. And the aliens in that book are really, really cool. And one of the things I like about them is that they are very different from people. And the author, Adrian Tchaikovsky, tries to take seriously what it means to be very different from people. And I think...
Right. Very different from humans, you mean, I think.
Yes, from humans, right.
Like, they are people, but they're not humans.
Yeah, right, exactly. The concept of people is not the same as the concept of human.
Right.
And one of the things he does, which I think is a really good way to approach this, is he thinks about creatures that exist on Earth, like in real life, that are very different from humans, which is to say that they are like not that closely related to humans, in like a tree in tree of life distance terms, you know?
Right.
And he uses them as an inspiration. I think that's so cool. I mean, in his case, it's spiders, and other creatures too, but the spiders are the sort of main ones.
Right. And especially in that book. Yeah. Others show up in the sequel a lot more.
Right. But I think that's a really good tactic because, I mean, you know, it turns out like Earth does have a bunch of non-human species.
Right.
Before I keep going too long, yeah, what do you think about it?
It's one of my favorite tactics in science fiction or fantasy. So one thing we've talked about this, like I like playing role-playing games, like D&D style role-playing games a lot. And I think D&D in particular has this like problem of like, oh, like, you know, orcs be like this and dragonborn be like that. And like, you know, all these species kind of having these like racial stereotypes associated with them. But one thing I've always loved to do whenever I do any like game design for D&D, whenever I do any like, you know, I'm going to build my own racial archetype that the players can play as. Like I'll do this kind of stuff from time to time. Whenever I do those homebrew rules, one of my favorite things to do is to pick an animal on Earth and ask, what would it look like if they developed sentience instead of us? And what might their society look like? Like, or rather even just take an animal and be like, what is their society? Right? Like, what is their society right now? Like, pretend that we don't think about them in terms of just animals, but like think about them in terms of people. What does their society look like to them? And that to me is always like a really kind of fruitful exercise. So I'm a really big fan of when Adrian Tchaikovsky does that with spiders and later octopodes, whatever. And then I'm also a really big fan of a book that directly inspired him. I mean, he calls it out in the text, but David Brin's Startide Rising, which features both uplifted species of both chimpanzees and dolphins. So you get these, you know, like kind of future dolphins that we have genetically engineered and like trained and stuff in order to be just as intelligent as us. But they also like have their own form of intelligence, have their own form of society, and even like think differently than we do. And because you get dolphin main characters and viewpoint characters, you get a really cool look into how they think. The same is true for the chimpanzee character in the novel, that there's only one. So whereas with the dolphins, you have a lot of them, and it's very much about their society and how it works. With the chimpanzee, you just have this kind of one character. And then another thing that novel does really well is there's also like alien aliens, right? There's aliens that are not within our same genetic tree of life. And they're handled like radically differently themselves. And they have in fact, like at times, like, you know, maybe just one viewpoint character per like this species of alien. And you just get to see the way that like their whole society, their technology, the way their jump drives work, the way they think, what their goals are individually versus as a society, like the way the hierarchies within their society work, the way that any individual one thinks are all just so different from the way that like humans think, the way that even like different societies of humans, which, you know, throughout time, throughout history, like, sure, we're all like the same species, but also like different people also think really differently. It's important to remember, like, different people have like different goals and wants and needs and like ways of behaving. And like here you have something even different. And so I that to me is one of those books that maybe surprising to people. I feel like it's very much of a type of science fiction I don't talk a lot about on the podcast, but like that book has always held like a kind of warm spot in my heart since I first read it, for like being like a really great with aliens.
That's a very fun book, and that series is fun. I think another older book that I really enjoyed back in the day, and I haven't read in a long time, so I don't remember it that well, but A Mote in God's Eye by Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell is also a book that I recall as having a really cool. It makes an attempt to depict a very alien race in a way that I really like. The entire book is kind of about humans trying to understand these aliens, like trying to understand really basic facts about these aliens. You know, they encounter them and they don't know anything about them. They don't understand like why their society does the things it does, or what their history is, or how they're sort of what they want changes over time. Mm-hmm. Like they have no ability. If you think of it in like a very, very, very simple abstract terms, humans meet this creature and they have absolutely no ability to predict what it's going to do next. And they struggle mightily over the course of the entire book just to understand like if they can like possibly come up with a way to predict what these creatures are going to do, like, and how they think and like what they care about.
Right.
And like, it's really fun.
A trope that is common to those kinds of stories, and I think that book does a really good job with too, is the like setting up something such that like, oh, both you as the reader and also the characters like think they know the way these things work, because like we've seen this kind of short term and we can make short term predictions, and those predictions are usually pretty right. And then we realize that like the underlying facts are actually very, very different. So our short term predictions work, our long term predictions are like woefully misguided. And like, you know, it's one of those things I really enjoy about that book, is that it all feels the kind of scientific mystery to it, and also the sort of like plot twists as they come. Like none of them are sort of like cheap. Like they all like they put a lot of work into the world building to kind of like make those all work well together.
Yeah, very good point. I think when you do this sort of thing effectively in stories that handle the really alien aliens effectively, like one of the things that's really important is to have a strong and like carefully crafted setup for your alien.
Yeah.
And to not just make it like everything's a mystery about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when this doesn't work as well, I feel like the thing that the author is trying to do is have it be this just like this sort of blank mystery. It's like a blank spot on the map. And like you just the story will just sort of like move around that blank spot.
Right.
And that I don't think that usually works.
I can think of one off the top of my head.
I don't know what
I should say. Oh, the Pandora's Star duology by Robert Hamilton, I think. Robert F. Hamilton, is that his name? I'm not a huge fan of him as an author. I feel I don't want to like shit talk anyone. Peter F. Hamilton. Like I kind of felt that way about like those books where there's a little bit of a like, ooh, mystery that like at the end of the day, like didn't like sort of, I don't know, like a lot of it just felt like mystery for the sake of mystery instead of like, I don't know, it very much fell flat for me. There's also like, you know, fucking like 3,000 pages over two novels that like could have easily been like a 600 page novel and I probably would have enjoyed it more, which I know some people like that. So, you know, it's fine if you like it. I don't mean to shit talk him at all. You know, different people like different things.
Yeah. Another thing that I, another book that I really like that takes another approach is Semiosis, which we read on this pod.
Yeah.
I was also going to bring that up. Sorry, what?
Oh, I was also going to bring that up. So I'm glad you did.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah, of course. That is another approach to the really alien that I really like. And it's okay, this is a creature that isn't even something that, like, it is both something that's inspired by real Earth life in the sense that it's a plant. And it is in some ways like similar to plants that exist in the world that we know. But it is also an attempt to depict something that is like, that is just totally different. It's almost like, okay, we have this space of like possible ways of thinking and being.
Yeah.
And like humans like exist in one little corner of this space and like other Earth life exists in like other, at other coordinates in this space. What if we just try to start at the coordinates of some life in this space, but then like go off into an unknown part of this, this possibility space, you know, what will we end up with? What are different ways of combining like known ideas about life that exists into unknown new things? I just really appreciate that. And like, you know, the way that Semiosis handles this is really concrete too, which I also really like. You know, the, it's not, like we're given a lot of POV from the perspective of this alien. And in the POV, we learn things about the, about how the alien sort of thinks of itself and like works and how its thoughts work. And one really fun thing that it tries to do is it tries to sort of have a really different concept of physical form than a lot of aliens are often depicted in stories. Like typically, whether it's sort of human or not, an alien is depicted as having a body in the way, in a recognizable way to a person,
right?
To a human, you know, like humans have bodies. We generally think of ourselves as in some sense overlapping with our physical bodies, even though I personally don't believe that's, I think that's, you know, misguided, but it's understandable why people think that. But in fact, like, you know, you can imagine, and indeed we know of life on Earth that is distributed in more complicated ways than that. You can think of an ant colony, for example. You know, what is the sort of lived experience of an individual ant in an ant colony? Well, I mean, you know, does that question make sense? Isn't that a bit like asking what's the lived experience of your eyeball? You know, I mean, or or is it not? I mean, that's a, those are sort of questions that we can conceive of.
Right.
Yeah. Those are questions we can conceive of. And so it makes sense to sort of try to literalize those in the classic science fiction way by like talking about a creature whose physical form is not one thing in the same way, or it's like not, it's more of like a bunch of things than it is one thing, perhaps.
Right. I mean, so talking about semiosis, I had this experience recently of helping my downstairs neighbors have a backyard because we have like what used to be a single family house and is now two units and I have the top unit. And they're building like a little garden out there and I've been helping with them with it from time to time. And one of the first times our neighbors, like our next door neighbors, have a tree. And that tree has sent these like roots out and is forming like new trees in our backyard. So one of the like, you know, first tasks that I took on was like digging up these other trees, these like root balls, which are like, you know, themselves kind of new trees, but also this other tree trying to grow into our yard. And like, you know, eventually like I have to like kill them and dig them up because they will strangle the like plants that we're trying to grow for food. But it made me think of semiosis the entire time I was doing it and these like networks underground and like, you know, this one tree is like its own tree, but it's also sending out itself, but also like new trees, like these things that are both new trees and also the same tree at the same time. And like, you know, but these new trees will like strangle the like plants that we want to grow. And, you know, it's like it's this whole like kind of dance underground. You know, there's like a rodent in the back. What are they called? Groundhog. There's a groundhog in the backyard too. And like my downstairs neighbor and I had this like long conversation about like, well, you know, it's just being, it's, you know, sure, it's eating the tomatoes, but it's like just an animal doing its own thing. You know, it's like, let's take this like more empathetic approach to it. And like, instead of like, oh, I got to kill that groundhog, be like, well, like, you know, how can we work around it to like, let it still be an animal in New York City, even while like we also have our needs. I don't know. It's sort of like, I kept thinking of semiosis as I was gardening, which I felt was a great, like spoke very well to semiosis, that like it kept coming up for me. And that's such a good question of like, okay, it's easy to like, for me to attack this root ball and be like, oh, this tree is going to like, you know, like steal the nutrients from the tomatoes we want to grow. But it's another thing to think about it as like, well, what if this tree has like feelings and thoughts and desires? And like, it definitely has, you know, some form of needs and desires, even if it doesn't experience them in the same way as we do. So like, what if it did experience them like we do? What does that look like?
You know, it's really interesting in one subset of old Buddhist and Jainist and Hindu philosophy. Mm-hmm. I say all three because it's sort of, I'm not aware of it like belonging exclusively to any of those traditions,
right,
but
right.
There exists a sort of philosophical investigation into the nature of, into the value of life. So if you believe, for instance, this is like a philosophical tack that Western philosophy has still to this day not quite taken, and it's a very interesting one, and I think it's really relevant to this discussion. Mm-hmm. And it's very relevant to the modern world. How do we compare very different forms of life? What kinds of heuristics can we use to understand the moral value or the ontology of different things that are so different? What sort of unifying ideas can we bring to our combined investigation of plants versus insects versus humans versus other creatures we haven't even seen but can conceive of? And one idea that exists is to think about a creature's sensitivity.
Hmm.
And what that means concretely is to think about how many different ways a creature has of perceiving the world around it, and to simply enumerate these ways and compare how many and what kind the ways are from creature to creature.
Interesting.
And this relates to how a Jainist, for example, or a Jain would try to determine the sort of life value of different living creatures, and to show, for instance, that like, although an insect may have in some sense less perceptive capacity than a larger mammal, nonetheless it has perceptive capacity,
right.
And this is like empirically observable. This is not like a very concrete claim that can be tested, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. That's one of the ways that, you know, Jain philosophers have justified a view that like, the view of ahimsa, like all these forms of life have value, moral value. And,
right.
I think it's very interesting. You know, if you're talking about like your thoughts about your backyard are like, these sorts of moral questions seem really abstract until you're digging up your backyard and you got to think about what you're going to do with a groundhog. It's a really concrete question.
Right. No, absolutely. And you know, that the point about the, like the Jainist and other sort of like Eastern philosophy, I guess Jainism is sort of like not quite Eastern. Anyway, like your point about like that kind of philosophical tack is a really interesting one. This thought of like, well, right. Like I think continental philosophy and analytic philosophy often take this view of like, well, it's not perception. It's like, you know, thought, right? It's like what you do with that perception that really matters from a moral point of view. You know, I mean, there's the kind of philosophy of mind and qualia. It's about whether you can perceive your perception or whether your perception just is, I guess. But then like you get the thing I immediately thought of, which is really good because I wanted to bring this book up too, is Binti and the sort of like radical empathy of Binti, both the book as well as the main character, right? Like in some ways her superpower is her ability to empathize with these like very different, dangerous, and even like morally in the wrong in some ways, like creatures that she comes across. And, you know, that's clearly the tentacle aliens.
Okuo,
right.
Okuo.
Like clearly like they're a part of that, but so is the shrimp ship, right? Like, so shrimp is this ship. Thing of like, you know, in a piece of science fiction, like written by David Brin or Adrian Tchaikovsky, which again, really like not saying anything about these, but like some of the investigation is like, well, what is it like to be a spider? What is it like to be a dolphin? What is it? And Binti is like, it doesn't matter what it's like to be a shrimp ship. A shrimp ship has value and like we should empathize with it and like treat it with respect. Right. And like there's something kind of radical about that point of view that like not a lot of Western sci-fi takes, but I always like appreciate when it does, where it's like, it's not just about what is it like, what do they think like, or what is their society like? It's also like, how do we relate ourselves to them? And like, I think when in, you know, I don't know much about Hindu or Jainist philosophy, but what I do know about the Buddhist philosophy that I've read is that that's a lot of what these sort of questions about the sanctity of life come down to. It's not just about like, oh, like we have to figure out what life matters and what life doesn't. It's that all life matters. And in fact, the really important thing is like how you relate to all life, like reflects on you and your values and like your kind of like being in a very important way. And like, you will be a better, happier person if you like relate to life in a more, you know, kind of full way, instead of being kind of close off to the fact of like the livingness of so many different things.
Totally agree. Love it. Love Binti. Binti's so good. Read Binti.
Yeah. And so I don't know. So Binti both has these, and you know, Binti also takes that same approach to like other human kind of philosophies and societies. And I think it, a way that is sort of like this model of like how we could potentially do that as individuals as well as, you know, as societies. Good stuff.
Very true. I have one question for you, Adrian. I don't know if
Absolutely.
You're up for this.
Yeah. Yeah. Cue time away.
So my question is, if you could have a very different experience, if you could sort of like experience being a very alien, like what would you want to experience? Would it be like having a distributed physical form? Would it be like having like some other sense? Like what would it be?
I'm going to answer this in kind of a roundabout way. In college, there was this story published in Wired that I really liked and read a whole bunch of times. And I've keep going back to about these people who do body modification, you know, sort of like piercing, but like one step above and beyond that, but do so in ways where they give themselves new senses. So for instance, one example is the guy who gave himself a sense of direction by wiring up a belt that was full of cell phone vibrators around the belt. So there were like 12 of them or something. And he had a little like compass, like also attached to the belt, so that whatever vibrator was pointing north would vibrate just like a hint of a vibrate against his skin. And he wore this for weeks. And eventually what happened was that he stopped noticing there being any vibration. And he just started noticing like he always knows what direction north is, because his brain sort of stops feeling it on its skin and just starts like rerouting this information into like directional information. And eventually it went even beyond that, where it went beyond like, I know what direction north is, and like, I know how to get back home. I know what direction home is, or what direction these other things are, because he begins like, all of a sudden he has this new data point that relates to everything he does. And he starts like fitting that data point into things. There's a story of someone else who cut open their pinky finger and inserted a like magnet covered in silicone and then sewed it back together so that I think it was a she had a sense of had an electromagnetic sense. Like she could sense electromagnetic fields, like magnets, but also just like wires in the wall, like all these other things would like tingle her pinky. And eventually, again, her brain stopped noticing that as my pinky tingles and starts noticing that as like, oh, there's this field that I can detect. Right. And like, I've always loved that idea. I've always loved the idea of like modding myself so that I have a new sense is kind of the long and short of this. And so, yeah, like a sense of direction of some sort, like, you know, some way of like always knowing direction would be really interesting to me. And I don't know why in particular that's the thing. I like, it's like, oh, I could fly. I could do, you know, I could like perceive things in parallel. I could be multiple consciousnesses at the same time. But no, I'm like, oh, I'd love a sense of direction. So there you go. That is my, you know, cool. Like stream of consciousness. Like what I actually think, not what my, you know, smarter brain thinks I should think.
Oh man, are you saying there's multiple intelligences in your physical form already?
Yeah. I mean, I think I generally do believe that, you know, or like maybe it's more accurate to say that there's like no single thing that it is to be me. We probably
is
both
like,
more or less agree.
Is it like Mimi Zero and Mimi One?
No, I think it's more along the lines of like any sense of like there being one cohesive identity is essentially an illusion. But again, Buddhist philosophy, to what degree is that like the Buddhist philosophy I've read? To what degree is that like me having always agreed with the Buddhist philosophy? I don't know. We'll let someone else figure that out.
The world is on fire. Down with Maya.
Right. I do kind of want to call out actually another book that's sitting right next to
me.
Because it's pretty cool. And I think it gets at this in kind of a different way. It is called Once Upon a Parsec, A Book of Alien Fairy Tales.
Sweet.
And it includes stories by both Adrian Tchaikovsky and Chris Beckett, who we've had on, or we've had Chris on as a guest, but we've read both of their books, as well as a bunch of other like pretty diverse voices. I think they are all British. I believe. Yeah, it is a UK published book. So I actually had to like order it from Britain and get it shipped over. I don't know if it's available as an ebook or if it's like really easy to get in any way, especially right now when the global supply chain is totally fucked up. But it's really cool. There's some really neat stories in here. And the gist is that every single story is a fairy tale or legend or something told from the perspective of an alien race that like has that particular fairy tale or legend or moral or like whatever it is. So it's really cool. It's a really like neat way of like approaching alien societies is like, you know, like what's an alien society like? Well, I don't know. What stories do they tell about themselves? What kind of fables do they have?
That's awesome. It reminds me of a short story in one of Ken Liu's Chinese sci-fi short story collections. Mm. I can't remember which collection or which story. So I'll have to get back on that. But
we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Yep.
Which one? Do you remember what the gist of the story?
No. The gist of the story was that it was a collection of fable-like tales told by aliens. It was a riff on Invisible Cities, actually.
Oh,
but
cool.
Like from the perspective of different species.
Right. Would that be the like title sake of the Invisible Planets?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's the story Invisible Planets. That's right. It has to be. No, that story is so good.
It is. I just love the roundabout way that we got there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's also, you know, Stanislaw Lem, I think, is another guy, as well as, I'm sorry, my voice sounds weird because I'm looking over, Robert Sheckley, another guy who I really like, sort of like these maybe older, more golden age science fiction authors who, you know, I think in a very different way wrote about aliens than maybe like the more modern sci-fi we've talked about, but also have these kind of very alien aliens in a really interesting way, both often as like short story writers writing these kind of almost like, I know like a Robert Sheckley story about humans and aliens meeting often feels more like a parable than it does a science fiction story. It often has this sense of like, the aliens behave in this bizarro way, but the bizarro way that they behave really kind of helps you identify how bizarro our own society is.
Another book that's got a really cool view of aliens that we've alluded to before on this podcast is The Book of Strange New Things.
Right. Is that like Michel Fabry, right? Something like that?
Yeah, I think so. That is a really cool book about a young priest evangelizing to aliens on this planet where humans have not had a presence really before. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because it simultaneously does the thing that we've talked about some of these stories doing, where it's sort of you know, you, the reader, are going along with this character trying to understand like anything about this species, you mm-hmm, know,
mm-hmm. And it's often sort of think you have mystery. An understanding and it's completely wrong, even though it fits all the facts that you have so far.
Right. But at the same time, it's taking a very different approach as well, because the book centers around this this religious mission and mm-hmm. is a lot about how humans, how like morally and literally, how should we relate to difference? Like how, what are our responsibilities in this situation? What are our beliefs about this and feelings about this? And how does this affect our other relationships? I mean, you know, the core of the book is this sort of, you know, epistolary relationship between the main character and his wife.
Right.
And how that's affected by his religious mission.
Mm-hmm. And also how anyway, it affects his religious mission, because she's yeah. going through very traumatic events back home on Earth, which he's like yeah. divorced from.
It's a really great book.
It's definitely so good. Recommend. It's so good. You gave me that book as a present, actually. That was very kind of you, because I loved that book.
Well, you're very kind yourself.
Aw. No, I think that's actually a really good call, because there it's like the aliens are very alien, but also, you know, so much of the book is about how like we alienate ourselves from ourselves, like how we kind of like delude ourselves, or how we don't feel what we're actually feeling and like tell ourselves like these stories about it. And I don't know. That's a book I wish more people talked about or read, because it feels very almost like useful in this present moment in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I like that book a lot.
Cool. Are there any other books or sort of like aliens or something like that? I mean, like, obviously it's like we could either talk about right, this for yeah. like, you know, 30 hours or like, you know, whatever. But I wonder if there's any like, you know, anything like big that we haven't hit on, you know, because we've talked a lot about the.
Well, there is
like
one thing yeah. that we haven't touched on, which is artificial life.
Ah, yes.
And obviously this is a major sci-fi trope. I think one thing that's interesting, so artificial life can be alien and it can be not alien at all. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things that happens in a lot of science fiction is, you know, in the same way that alien species can often relate to race on Earth or biology on Earth, artificial life can often relate to those things as well. Mm-hmm. And one of the sort of other aspects of artificial life is because it's created, there's, you know, the Prometheus fable or the Frankenstein story, you know, involves a certain amount of like parent-child investigation, like investigating that mm-hmm. parent-child relationship or the ancestor-descendant relationship, which is a whole other way to think about alien life. And it's like related to this whole other thing that science fiction does, which is there's sometimes posited in sci-fi stories, especially like giant space operas, a kind of hierarchy of like intelligent life.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's like this like Whig version of history on like mega steroids, where you have like this sort of, there's a way somehow of like rating the progress of a species on right. its like journey towards sort of mastery over existence or like enlightenment or something.
Right. Sublimation, whatever it is.
Right. Right. In some cases, this means that like a different species, you know, who are further along might eventually sort of attain such heights of spiritual transformation that they like exit this plane right. of existence.
That's childhood's end, which we exactly. read recently.
Exactly. It's childhood's end, but it's also Foundation Earth. But it's also yeah. like right. Babylon 5 has this. Like, oh, I mean, it's all over the place. Yeah. It's all over the place.
I think even Ian M. Banks
yeah,
has
Ian M.
a
Banks,
degree.
Yeah. And it's actually that sort of way of thinking about there's different ways of that working as well. But like that also relates to the artificial life conversation, because one of the things that happens is that there can be uplifts, or there can be sort of the elder races helping the younger races mm-hmm. by like giving mm-hmm. them, you know, a leg up technologically or spiritually or something.
Right. The David Brin thing.
Yeah. And those kind of ancestor descendant or like parent child style relationships are really another aspect of this sort of dealing with multiple species thing that goes on. I mean, it mm-hmm. relates to real biology on Earth also, because like humans typically think of ourselves in this way relative to our pets, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
it's got one on my lap right now.
Yeah, we breed these creatures to strange ends, known perhaps not even to ourselves.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And like, part of our breeding relationships with them are that we want them to love us and we want to love them. And it's very strange if you think about it. And I think that's another thing that's investigated by some of these alien discussions in sci-fi.
Well, I will use this plug to say right now is a very good time to adopt a dog or cat, especially because a lot of people are having to like give them up as economic times turn hard. And they're very nice to have in quarantine. And if you do, please do adopt, because that's a lovely way to like help another life form out, as opposed to, you know, breed one for your own ends. Yeah, I think that, you know, it's like the artificial intelligence in some way is a totally different conversation. And in some ways, just like, you know, well, all these intelligences are artificial because they're all like people kind of making them up and telling stories about them.
Indeed.
Which I think is maybe, you know, one, like two authors in particular come to mind for me for this one. Ian M. Banks, like I mentioned, because he has both a lot of alien species who often have like viewpoint chapters. Like Look to Windward, I think, has like one human viewpoint chapter in the whole novel, which is one of my favorite books of his. I think it's just really phenomenal. But then you also have Werner Vinge's Zones of Thoughts trilogy, which I'm only particularly fond myself of the first one. I know people like A Deepness in the Sky a lot, but I really only like A Fire Upon the Deep. But that novel has some really cool alien stuff going on, from dogs that have distributed intelligences, such as the pack is intelligent, even while any individual dog is not, to like intelligent ferns, to like kind of like galactic spanning like Usenet like user forums. That's a really kind of interesting book when you're talking about like a lot of different ways it is to be a person like in this kind of alien landscape.
I haven't read the Zones of Thought stuff.
Oh, it's, you know,
we don't need it. I
have issues with a lot of Vinge's work, but I think in particular, Fire Upon the Deep is like a really interesting piece of fiction, even with all of the issues I have with it and like more generally his stuff. You know, I think too, we should say that the book we're currently reading is, you know, also has this whole sort of like ship mind thing going on, just like not just like, but like kind of obviously I feel like you can't have ship minds without being in some way like calling out Ian Banks, but you know, the ship minds in The Tea Master and the Detective by Elliot de Bodard, which we're reading this month, are like very different in a lot of ways, but also like there's something really like nice and like kind of vital about them. This idea that like ships are in a lot of ways just like people, but also it's like the things that they're just like people about are like totally different than the things that people are like people about. You know, it's like they still have societies that kind of shun people for being different, but like the way that you're different is very different than the way that you're different in a human society. You know, the way that you have mothers and fathers and children is like very different than the way humans have, like, you know, parents and children. But there is still a way that it is to have parents and children. So I'm really enjoying that book from this perspective too.
Yeah.
We'll obviously talk about that more next week.
Indeed.
Cool.
Sounds good.
All
sounds
right.
Good,
any final,
I feel,
final thoughts?
I feel good about this.
Yeah, but any good, like, you know, pithy thoughts to wrap it all up and put it in a bow for our listeners?
Windows and mirrors, man.
That's what people come to us for, is pithy thoughts that wrap everything up in a nice bow.
Windows are mirrors, and, you know, perception can matter more than thought. How's that?
Sounds good. Sounds good to me. That's a very nice bow. Okay, well, thank you everyone for listening. This was a lot of fun, Matt, to do. Like, I feel like we haven't done one of these kind of like, you know, just simple, easy, topic-based, us kind of shooting the shit episodes in a while.
What are you talking about, easy? I busted my ass.
It's just nice to do right now when the world is on fire. Fire upon the deep, more like a fire upon everything.
My bhikkhus.
Yeah, so thank you for listening. Thank you to WJ for our music and Noah Bradley for our artwork. You can find us at Spectology Pod on Twitter or email us at spectology@gmail.com. We always love reader comments and we'll, you know, call you out later potentially. Also, you know, this podcast is Spectology, spectology.com. If you want to like find us, listen to us, subscribe, all that good stuff. You know, and yeah, we'll be back next week with our post read with Julia Rios of Elliot de Bodard's The Tea Master and the Detective. That's been a really nice like novella to read right now. And, you know, as we're recording this, Hugo nominations are about to come out. So let's go see what is nominated for Hugo's this year. And we'll maybe talk about that later, too. All right, guys. Bye, Matt.
Peace out.
Bye.